And now they're trying to get back maybe into their homes, and they're facing, and you can read in the Mansour Pashtun's postings how the army treats people at these checkpoints. And it's not a very pretty picture. And it's hierarchy, and it's power, and it's the abuse of you know. And so the problem of the, you know, now if the militant Taliban are pushed into Afghanistan now, which is why eastern Afghanistan is so much trouble the last couple of years, this will still take years to settle down eastern Afghanistan. But this area is basically occupied by the Pakistan Army now. And so what does that mean for some kind of new relationship with the center and a new kind of society in Pakistan? And the federally administered tribal areas now are nominally abolished. The areas are merged with the districts here. But the transition process, it's a perfect Pakistani bureaucratic document, an 80-page document of a 5-year transition plan where nobody loses their job. The political agents, the police, everybody who ran the abuse of power system in the federally administered tribal area still keeps their job. The Fatah Secretariat, all the bureaucrats still keep their job. They change their titles. They have a 5-year transition plan. At some point, they're supposed to have regular courts, regular police stations. They haven't got them yet because the bureaucrats are stalling and they don't want to really change things. And so the people are in limbo. On paper, they have rights. Things are changing. In reality, who controls the truck traffic, the rent collecting, the bribery? The same people who controlled it 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago. And the authorities who control all of that don't want to give it up. And it's the economy on the border. And they're going to stay there, and they're going to hold that as long as they can. So if the Pashtun Protection Movement can generate some civil society action, including in Lahore, in Islamabad, and Karachi, and end some of those targeted killings in Islamabad, and the policemen accused of killing Naqibullah Massoud had been killing people like that since the 90s, since the 80s probably. And he was a favorite of the Pakistan People's Party. There were a couple of times when he was promoted and pushed up to put in charge of police districts in Karachi to basically crush the MQM, the Mohajir Party there. And he did. They estimate that policeman, one count said his police district probably had 445 or something, you know, extrajudicial killings over a certain period of time, where, you know, it was just how you handled people that were troublesome. Were they criminals? Were they Taliban? The courts don't work. There's never going to be any justice. There's a bad guy, you go shoot him. And this is an Asian thing. It isn't Karachi. It isn't, you know, this is how power works. So I don't know if that answers too much of anything. Well, a question here and then one here.
Thank you. Actually, it's to follow on from this. I'm glad you mentioned the history. And a movement like this doesn't come out of nothing. It comes out of a lot of pressure building up. And one of the reasons, I mean, I've been living in Pakistan, in and out, and China and other places for the last 10 years. So, and obviously linked intrinsically into the power centers. But being a Pashtun as well, I always had a different take on things, having been brought up in England and things. And I traveled the whole area there, and I can testify to the fact that whenever the military went in, they did bombard the villages and made a lot of IDPs, internally displaced people, but the people were never accepted outside Pakhtunkhwa. And you have, during the campaigns in 11, 12, 13, 14, you'd have masses of people migrating somewhere, but they can't get anywhere, and nobody would take them in. And literally, Punjab government, the province of Punjab, would say, nobody's coming here, we don't want you. So what's the point of having a nation then? And when it really comes down to it, it's the fact that, when I've really thought about this, because it was an identity thing for me as well, being brought up in England as a Pashtun, and then going back and trying to understand what I was, and never accepted by anybody, actually, whether I'm in England or here or whatever, or Pakistan. So I've got my own take on things, but this is a special issue because you want. Really, fundamentally, it comes down to this. The British Raj, and this is the form of forward policy that the British Raj had at that time, and the Pakistani government, which is predominantly attracted to by Punjab. Yeah, that's where power center really is. And the other minorities are smaller, so they have a generally greater share of power. And as a result, they tend to dictate those policies towards the minorities because they've got a large share of the power and instruments of power there. The fundamental thing is that Abdul Ghaffur Khan, or Ghaffar Khan, sorry, both my grandfather's name is Ghaffur Ghaffar, so I get confused.
Bachan.
is that contention is that Pakhtunkhwa, or Northwest Frontier at that time, was never given an option. The option was go to India or stay in Pakistan. But it was not to join the Pakhtuns or the Pashtuns in Afghanistan, which was a natural option for them because the same ethnic group. And so that's where the main contention is, and that's where the main fissure is as far as the Pakistani government is concerned as a power center, and that's why they've always been afraid. And every single policy that they've had, so I'm giving a lecture now, all the single policy that they've had, I mean, this is just from another take of it,
so this is
has
this
been exactly for that reason, to maintain central control on those people, and anything that's related to any disaffection would be put down immediately and labeled a non-state entity.
So here's a post-colonial problem in the post-colonial world. It's not a Pashtun problem in Pakistan.
Yep.
It's the Kurds in Iraq,
exactly.
Iran, you know, wherever, right? The state builders are trying to build states in the post-colonial world, and what tools do they use? And we take it for granted that the nation state is a natural condition, that everything works border to border, the post office, the policemen, the phones, everything is just a nation state. The rest of the world is still trying to build that, and they often do it through coercive methods and power centers. After the Army Public School killings in Peshawar, that school was targeted. The militants said, "You're killing our families and schools here in Waziristan. We're going to show you what it feels like." And those children at an Army Public School were the children of the military elite there in the cantonment. When that happened, Pakistan just went around the country, and any Afghan refugees that may have been there for decades, they just picked them up and shipped them back from Lahore to Islamabad, and just started to send them back to Afghanistan. So just at the time refugees are coming one way from the federally administered tribal areas, they're blocked from going into the interior even more. And of course, many of the populations along here don't have that documentation and the birth certificates, and they have family on both sides. So this idea of creating a nation state, creating the borders, it's never happened before. The Pakistan Army and government are claiming they're going to fence the whole border here, and they've got some, you know, a few miles of fence here and there, but they, of course, they can't fence it any more than we're the richest country in the world. We haven't fenced half of our southern border, right, just technically to do it. But that idea of creating a national territory now and trying to control it in ways that it was never controlled before, all during the last 15, 20 years of war in Afghanistan, the Pashtuns going across the border here in the Khyber Pass or down here going to Kandahar, that border was wide open. 10, 20, 30, 40,000 people would cross every day, Pashtuns, with no papers, going back and forth, just because they were Pashtuns. And who were the terrorists, who were the smugglers, who were whatever, there was no control over it. And only the last couple of years have they really tried to control those borders. So the state building, my interest as a historian, the state builders trying to build states, even 500 years ago, I write about the Peshawar rally, 1500 to 1900, the Mughal Empire is trying to build a state, an imperial state. And they can control the roads and some of the cities, but then that society out there has got its own kind of agenda. And that's still much of the world today. So here is a moment when the state, You know, I said after in Ben's edited volume, I think the conclusion from my article about this problem in Swat in 2009, after all that trouble with the Taliban and the recovery of the area by the army, the winners were the army, who stayed there and are building their posts, and they're not going to leave. And the army isn't going to leave these areas here. They're going to be there forever. And then when does that civil society get built? When do those institutions get built that are schools and hospitals and not just tax collectors and policemen, right? And so this is the debate in developing countries. They don't want a road because they don't get a hospital in the school, they get a policeman and a tax collector, right? And so when does civil society feel they're getting a fair share? And here's the Pashtun movement. First of all, don't arrest us and kill us. And especially innocent people. And we know who they are, and when it's going on in Karachi and the policemen are doing it, did Naguibullah have 10 million rupees that he had collected so he could buy a new business, and the police heard about it and they picked him up and they were extorting money out of him, and then they killed him because they tortured him so badly they couldn't let him go? That's one story floating around. I don't know what the truth is. It's all on the internet, right? But these are the stories that are stirring up this activism. It's very interesting.
The truth of the matter is that the Pashtun have been seen as second-class citizens by the majority population and continue to be so. This is not a nation state, so it's a fallacy to think this is.
And they use the language of racial discrimination. The language that's used in the West.
Professor and. For 10 years, I suffered racism non-stop. But that doesn't mean that I didn't in England. I suffered a lot of racism there for different reasons. But the fact of the matter is, it's really not the way you might think it. It's not a cohesive country, like any country in the third world, or should I say, less developed world. Like in India, there's many different ethnic groups, and there's small ones, larger ones.
It's a work in progress. And it's only 70 years.
Not been long. But this country in itself has been the periphery of two large empires for a couple of thousand years. So having that as a country and going back to Gandhara, the original settlement that happened in the Indus civilization, and thinking that will occur again after thousands of years of separation because it's been moving back and forth across that river, and the Pashtun are very, very different. We're very different from Punjab and other places. How are you going to mix two cultures, two nations, or three or four nations, into make a nation state?
So the nation building project continues.
It's a failure from the beginning.
One of the leaders of the lawyers movement, Itisaz Hasan, wrote a book about the Indus Valley civilization. You know, Pakistan was the Indus River. It wasn't religion, it was the Indus River. So we have to adjust our identity to something else. It's still a work in progress, and there's no agreement on it. So.
But it's 2,000 years later.
Let's move to the back of the room.
Yeah, the back row, a couple questions back there.
I wanted to ask about sympathy for the Pashtun movement. I'm a student here at GW, and I don't know anything about this issue, so I was hoping to learn some more. What are the sympathies in the other regions, like Balochistan, I don't even know if that's the correct term, the Punjab region, the Sindhi regions, for the Pashtun movement? And if there are sympathies, how great are they, or how effective has the government press censorship been to stop those from growing?
Maybe we could collect a couple.
I'm Raheel. I'm also a student here. Sorry to bring the discussion back to the political aspect, but there's a couple of people connected with the PDM who are now also members of the National Assembly. So is that the PDM trying to get political legitimacy in the state's institutions, or just having a seat at the table so they can raise their issues in a more formal forum? As in, I want to know what the process is. Obviously, nobody knows what the process behind it is, but like, what is the intention behind them trying to get that political?
Okay. Let me take these two here. Pakistan has been seen by the Baluch and the Pashtuns and the Sindhis as under the thumb of the biggest province and the largest chunk of the population, the Punjab and the Punjabis. So it was the Punjabis who were dominant in the military in the British Empire. And after 1947, very quickly they were dominant in the bureaucracy and the government. And so whatever the truth of the power relationship is, the Baluch especially have suffered as the state wants to build infrastructure and new ports and highways and things in Baluchistan. The Baluch are saying, well, you're taking our natural gas, we don't get any back, it's the Punjabis' fault. And so Baluch nationalists have been targeted every 10 years by one government or another, and thousands of them have been killed. And there's an active movement in Baluchistan today where people disappear every week and are killed. And it's by Baluch militia that are allied with the police and the frontier corps and the intelligence agencies, and nobody's to blame and people are dead. So this is happening all the time, and it's not, it's not known internationally necessarily, but it's part of the problem. And so this is why when there's an election coming in the summer of 2018, the movement starts under the Abbasi government, which is Nawaz Sharif's legacy government after he's dismissed, and they push through the merger of Fatah and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa right at the end of their term. They didn't want to do it earlier because it might get a vote block against them in the election, right? But then they have the election. Two of the Pashtun regional candidates get elected, and they immediately are in with the movement, and they're the half dozen leaders of the movement. These couple of politicians are there all the time on social media. For one thing, they have impunity against arrest and being shot at too much anyway, right? And so they have a bigger voice. Their voice is amplified by supporting the movement. And then the Imran Khan issue is very interesting because his party ran the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province for the previous term. And then he wins the whole thing and becomes prime minister. And his identity politics as a politician was, and I'm a Pashtun too. I'm a Pakhtun too. So I'm, I have honor and I'm, And he really makes that claim. So it's good for the Pashtun protection movement, right? Because he's got to be nice to them in some ways without alienating a constituency that he's, maybe created or recruited or identified with. And so the movement's got some room there to play. They've got a couple parliamentarians, and now they're in a regular political setup, and they can push for regular kinds of legislation. So the future is politics, right? Politics is power and money and who gets it. And Pashtuns and Sindhis and Baluch are always going to be on the fringes of the core of the nation state project. But if they can negotiate a bigger share of the development money, the investment money, my argument has always been there won't be peace in Afghanistan until there's peace right here. And getting rid of the frontier crimes regulations, integrating Fatah into the province, creating a normal political situation here, allows, that's going to stop that militancy from, being pushed across the border by those who are interested in pushing militancy across the border. So my connection with Kashmir, I was talking about earlier, I can make the case about this moment in history is going to contribute to some violence in Kashmir. If you look back at the end of the Soviet war in Afghanistan, and they signed a peace agreement in 1989, when does the violence start in Kashmir? 1988, 1989 again? There's a lot of unemployed militants in 1988 and 89, and I think the intelligence agency said, why don't you go to Kashmir and harass those Indians? I don't know where the car bomb came from in Kashmir last week.
No, but Valakot's just right up there.
But they sell fertilizer in India. And that might have been a fertilizer bomb. But it wouldn't surprise me if there's more trouble in Kashmir, as the government of Pakistan, they seem to be cutting a deal with the Taliban and the Americans and Ashraf Ghani right now. And if they can calm this area down, what about those several thousand militants left who want to go do something? And maybe some of them will end up in Kashmir, unfortunately. So that's an educated guess, maybe. Bitter voice of experience.
We're just about out of time, but I I'm just chomping at the bit here because so much of this echoes with my own current work. And just to kind of complicate that, I agree with you, but I disagree with the Fatah as a state of exception. Because the Fatah is not a derogation from the norm, it marks the norm of the post-colonial present. I mean, that's how Pakistan was constructed. Just as you were saying earlier, that these post-colonial states inherit the colonial legacy, inherit a disaggregated, multi-jurisdictional, very hierarchical set where there are second-class citizens, third-class citizens, non-citizens. I mean, Fatah residents don't have citizenship till 2001. So I think there's a significant question about how fundamentally, if Pakistan is able to integrate the Fatah, and I think that's a big question, how fundamentally will it change Pakistan?
Well, it's a 200-year project for all of us, yeah. Right? Pakistan's had a long history of assertions of acts that are claimed to be legal under my interpretation of the law. And in some ways, that's the state of exception or something. The doctrine of necessity. We're going to change the government with a coup and install a new government. And you know, it's the doctrine of necessity. Don't worry about that constitution. There's all kinds of legalistic ways to assert power and manipulate, from the frontier crime regulations, the whole British Empire. And in the post-colonial world, people write the laws to suit their displays of power in some ways. Can Pakistan get away from that? And can other countries get away from that? Can everybody get away from that? So who gets self-determination in the world? Who gets justice? How do you get justice? I mean, it's very, very simple questions. And the Pashtun guys are saying, well, we want justice too. And everybody knows when our guys get killed, when they're innocent, because the whole world knows now. So,
great.
It's on social media.
Yeah. I think we'll have...
Yes, one last question.
Last one to Max.
And I'll be hanging around here for a little bit, too.
You've given this great talk. And I liked it. I benefited very much from it. But you have not talked about a big elephant in the room, which is drones and American pressure on Pakistan to do what they're doing.
Well, and so the Pashtun Protection Movement says the government has been implicated in all stirring up all this violence. And it's Musharraf cooperating with the Taliban and bringing all this attention and violence to our area. It's the Pakistan military that has brought these drones and this war to us. If he hadn't been supporting the Taliban to go into Afghanistan and attack the Americans, this is their take on it. And they say that directly in public at their rallies. And this is something that you can't say in Pakistan, but they've done it. Now, does that mean they're all going to end up in jail over the next 2 or 3 years? We'll find out. And Mansour Pashtun is, will he get killed after he publishes in the New York Times and everybody in the world knows who he is? People get killed all the time in Pakistan. So it's a contest. And who wins that contest? We'll find out. A year from now, 2 years from now, the government is going to just use all the levers. They've banned him from television this last interview. He's saying, they won't broadcast my interview. So they're just going to squelch it. They're just going to brush it under the carpet as best they can, hope it goes away. They're actually going to try and get the chief minister of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa to engage them in conversations that will just bury them and talk.
You'll keep your job.
And they've already rejected, the movement's rejected getting involved in tribal jirgas that the government says you should do. And they say, no, we want the Constitution. We don't want this stuff. We want the rule of law.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Rob, for a real tour de force of the podcast.